Hey Stuart, hey Tracy.
Morning.
No questions came in, so as usual, if either of you have anything, go ahead.
I don't even yeah, I
Feel
just
free to
got
think about it too.
no, I just got a blood smart test back.
Okay.
I'm always surprised how fast they get stuff done. The
Yeah.
draw was on Saturday morning and everything was finished by 5 o'clock this morning. The biggest thing that has always concerned me is that I have a kind of a high fasting glucose, or one of the things that stands out. And it was higher. It's the highest number I've had, which is 109. And it's funny because in the 2 or 3 days leading up to the test, I had some intermittent fasting. And the night before I might have had a little bit of I think I did have a popsicle type thing that I get from Trader Joe's that's mango and ice cream. So, but it's more than 12 hours before. And I don't, what do you think about 109 as a fasting glucose number?
Fasting glucose by itself doesn't tell us that much. I
Okay.
would want to see. If you really wanted more data, fasting insulin or C-peptide, a CGM, honestly, just to see what you're doing over the course of the day, which I'm guessing based off of your diet is relatively steady. If you really really wanted to go the extra mile, something called a Kraft insulin assay, where you go in and you do a glucose tolerance test, but they're measuring both glucose and insulin for 2 or 3 hours after you drink that glucose solution. Given what I know about you and in the context of who you are, I'm not concerned about that 109 fasting, especially if leading up to it you were doing a little bit more intermittent fasting. Depending on how extreme the fasting is, and that's obviously going to be relative to the person. That does seem to spike that morning glucose more. Low carbohydrate diets seem to do the same thing. So really, I'm most concerned, most excited about your postprandial levels, not your fasting, unless it starts continuing to creep
Right.
up and you're getting to
So,
consistently 115, 120. The other thing is it's just one point in time.
right. And
So
the thing you're also saying is that if I had intermittent fasting or was really low, I mean, I definitely have been lower carb and it shows up. I mean, and I don't know how much triglycerides are affected by the previous few days, but I was probably calorie deficient in the 3 or 4 days before. And so it was
That
a
could be a
low
stressor
triglyceride.
too, and
What's that?
that could potentially also be a stressor, which could potentially increase your fasting blood glucose from
Okay.
like a cortisol perspective. So, I'm not concerned. It
Okay.
doesn't even remotely excite me.
Okay. Well, that's nice. And then there was one other thing that I was thinking of. No, so I'm not looking at you. I'm looking at my screen for
Oh,
something
sure.
else. I have I'm not sure what it was, but I do see one other thing that's interesting. Where's Trying to find, why can't I find this? Oh, there it is. The reticulocyte count is really low. I mean, it seems low to me. And then, or absolute, I guess absolute reticulocytes are still in the range that's green, but it's on the low end. And I end up with this, like the last four tests have red blood survival, and they're all over the map. Because the first time it said it's a calculated number, I know. It said 167 four tests ago or three tests ago, whatever. And then 111 and then 110 for days. And now this time it's 143. And to me, it seems to be more about what the numbers came up as than it is like some reality. It's like other little swings in these things seem to make a difference in those numbers.
Yeah. What were your red blood cells?
Red blood cells. Where is that? White, red, RBC, serum. Why do I not? Oh, RBC?
RBC, yeah.
4.64, so a little low.
A little low. What about your hemoglobin?
It's always been a little low. I mean, this is historically, this is all in this range. It's 14.1 for hemoglobin and 43.3 for hemocrat.
Okay. Hemocrit. And did your reticulocytes change significantly from last time?
In the four tests, they were 0.6, 0.9, 1, and then 0.7. And when the number was up, of course, that influences the red blood survival number. And then when it drops, it influences it too.
Yeah. So reticulocytes are premature red blood cells. There are a lot of things that can influence that. If they're jumping around like that, it may or may not really be indicative of a true red blood cell survival. If that's what you're getting at, I would agree.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on it. It's just like sometimes the numbers might mean something, but sometimes they might just be getting funny readings.
Right. And that's, you know, that's why taking the numbers and interpreting them in the context of everything else, in the context of the person, you know, and knowing what the numbers mean is important. And it is important to know, like you mentioned, that the RBC survival is a calculated value, which is imperfect by itself. Anything that's calculated is going to be imperfect, but it's kind of the best we have. So
yeah,
if that's consistently very high or very low for someone, that's where, you know, I might be thinking about what could be going on. But if yours is kind of all over the map,
exciting. The first time the red blood survival, I think you said it was the highest one you'd ever seen when it was 167.
Yeah, that's quite high.
But then it was 111, 100, which seems almost, the average is supposed to be 120, right?
But that's also, you know, if we're putting that into relative terms based off of other numbers that I've seen, it's still relatively high. But again, it's one of those things where so many things can impact, you know, both the reticulocytes and the other markers that go into that calculation.
Yeah, my red blood cell count doesn't seem to vary that much. You know, the highest number was 4.78 and the lowest number was 4.54. But the variation in the red blood survival is massive because the reticulocyte count is all over the place.
Right, which makes me, because that RBC count is pretty stable, right, that also makes me think that it's not a great marker to track for you, the reticulocyte.
Yeah, something's not working. Something's not coming up right the way they tested or the way we're looking at it or something. Yeah. And the other one was just, sometimes there are things that makes my brain go, when you guys calculate fatty liver index, what's in that calculation?
You know, there are a lot of calculations. Let me see if I can.
And is it's more than just your height and your weight and your
weight. I believe.
I mean, I have a really low number no matter what, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, so I know your liver enzymes go into it, ALT, AST, probably GGT, and then maybe triglycerides as well.
Oh, okay.
Let me see if I can figure out, because there's multiple calculations.
What is GGT?
It's another liver enzyme.
Oh, okay. And that one is one that has been borderline low or just below, you know, it's low in the low standard range. It's I'm 10 or 12 is where I'm at for GGT.
Right. When it's high, that's when it's concerning. So it's height, weight, waist circumference, triglycerides, and GGT. So I guess we're not including in this one the ALT and AST, which is probably good because those are touching.
So one of the things that moves the number around has been triglycerides too, because that's the one that probably varied. And it hadn't varied that much, but, you know, my triglycerides were way low again. You know, I was 41 and 43 in a couple tests ago, and then I started trying to eat more calories, and I got up to 57. And then I don't know how much the fasting I did in the last week or 3 or 4 days in advance. It was more than that. Intermittent. It wasn't every day, but I know that once I start doing that, it's also harder because then I'm more likely not to get 3 meals a day on days when I think I'm going to get 3 meals a day.
Is there any reason you'd want your triglycerides slightly higher? Like, are you thinking those in the 40s is too low?
I don't know. I used to think it was an energy problem. And at least right now, I haven't seen it as an energy problem, but I haven't been doing the intermittent fasting for very long, and I'm not planning on doing it every day. Because I don't think I can, I think it's a challenge for me to get enough calories if I do it every day. I'm kind of playing with it to see if it has a positive impact on my gut. I sort of feel like the way my stool quality is like, you know, once in a blue moon, I have what I think is a really good stool quality. Most of the time it's like a 2 or a 3 on the scale, and sometimes it's a 0 or 1, it's full on diarrhea. The other interesting thing was I ate a super fatty meal on Saturday night and didn't think I had any negative effect.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, it was just, I went out to dinner with a friend to a steakhouse that specializes in all kinds of different meat dishes and had all some really good stuff. And it was just like, okay, this is going to be a good test. How am I going to feel? And I really didn't notice that it created a problem.
Excellent.
So, yeah. And I'm pretty sure it was all good quality fats too. You know, when it was added fat, it looked like it was probably olive oil and, you know, because this was a really nice restaurant. It's a place I can't afford to go that often, but a friend of mine and I go once a year to celebrate our birthdays, which was a long time ago now, but we finally got out.
That's great.
I'll make a follow-up appointment with you because I want you to look at my whole setup, of course. And okay. The other question, I guess, is do you have any recommendation? I have a primary care physician appointment on Thursday, and I'm sure she's going to look at my LDL cholesterol and go, oh my God, because my LDL is 287.
Yeah.
And my HDL is 70, but my triglycerides are 43.
Yeah.
And the highest they've been in the last couple of years measured was 57. So, and I guess the other thing is if I was going to look for information to share with her as to why I don't think that's a big deal, where would you suggest I go?
I can send you a couple of things. You're not going to find a ton in the literature unless you're trying to collate a bunch of studies, and then it ends up being a PhD thesis by itself, right?
Right.
So I can send you a couple of what will probably be like opinion papers that just kind of that have been, you know, published in peer review journals. That at least kind of shed light on some alternative ways to view LDL cholesterol in the face of, you know, low triglycerides, high HDL, that kind of thing.
We talked about the presentation given, you remembered his name and I don't, Dave somebody in the ancestral health community.
Feldman?
Yeah, probably.
Or, yeah.
And he, I don't know if it's that name or not, but because Feldman, anyways, and he had gone through a bunch of all cars mortality data and decided that he didn't think it was an issue provided your triglycerides were under 100.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think anything like that has been published.
Okay.
You know, it's again a lot of people kind of doing some background unpublished research, but there's one in particular. Oh, I think maybe this is it. Hang on. Yeah, so they go into here. I'll share my screen. This is David Diamond, Ben Beckman, and Paul Mason. Statin therapy is not warranted for a person with high LDL on a low carb diet, and they go into some of the science and the reasoning behind why they believe that. So again, it's an opinion piece, but it's probably one of the these guys are, you know, whether or not that's ultimately the case, it's hard to say, but because we don't have the long-term studies, right? But they, I remember them making a good scientific argument. So,
yep.
I will, I'll actually pull up your Trello board right now and just post this to it.
Cool. Thanks.
Can you send that to me also, please, Megan?
Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Is there, do you think, an upper limit also to HDL where it, you know, stops being beneficial for it to go so high? And like mine's what, 109 or something, I think. Like, is it, it keeps climbing just like the LDL and the total?
Yeah, for sure. But it's hard to determine whether or not that's actually pathological outside of the context of like a research setting. But yeah.
What do you mean determine if it's pathological?
So you can actually measure HDL function inside of a research setting. So we can't really, we don't have the tools yet to do that, like through Quest or LabCorp or whatever. But yeah, once for women it starts going above, I don't remember our range. It's either 90 or 100. Then you start kind of thinking about what could be going on, why dysfunction could be occurring. So to answer your question, yes, it's something that can go too high, but it being too high isn't necessarily indicative of something being wrong.
Okay.
Yeah. I would personally start by looking for other sources of inflammation, either subjectively or objectively, to get a better idea of what could be going on with the HDL. Mm-hmm. It's not the perfect way to go about it, but it's at least a good place to start based off of what we know about it.
And cause for it rising, would it not necessarily be the same as the others, like increased saturated fat intake over the past year?
Correct. Yeah.
Now, correct that it would be a different reason.
Usually some sources of saturated fats can, like coconut oil, can cause an increase in both HDL and LDL, but typically they're mm-hmm. different reasons for them going up.
And what about olive oil? That's something else over the past year I've or liberally on things.
Mm-hmm. That typically is going to, it typically has a cholesterol lowering effect with total cholesterol. And it also seems to raise HDL a little bit. Now, whether the amount you're consuming is enough to really like raise your HDL significantly mm-hmm. is hard to say, especially because the studies that look at that are looking at typically people with metabolic syndrome to begin with. So they already have wonky lipids. So they typically have very low HDL. They add in olive oil and it may increase. For someone who already gotcha. Has high HDL, I don't know how much of a factor that would be.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
Sort of a point of interest, frustration this week, with, you know, my valve, my plumbing system turning bad over the past month, is that our sewer line backed up for the first time in a year.
Oh no.
That for the 2.5 years of dealing with this prior to it, you know, kind of shifting and getting better last spring, happened with some regularity. Didn't happen for the past year and happened again a couple nights ago. Like, yep, it's not large amounts. And we have a bidet now. It's not the toilet paper. I think it's the stickiness of the stool consistency and the where our house is in the neighborhood and where the sewer line goes. There's no house above us that any water comes through when they flush. So we're at kind of a more susceptible point. We're kind of arguing with the city over this. And we have a personal plumber now and have him on, you know, used to have him on speed dial and had the city out multiple times. So we're dealing with that part of the issue, is that there's no other house above us that would help wash it down. But yeah, I think it's just that it's so sticky and it's kind of creating a bit of a dam, and then just little bits gather up. It's not like big, huge amounts that clog it at once, but sort of a you know, a tangible thing that occurred, like that it's more than just like, oh, this is in my mind that it's getting worse. Like, no, like, look here, these backups used to happen. They didn't happen. And now they are again.
I'm sorry. That's,
yeah,
that's not something you want to have to deal with on top of everything else.
Right. Yeah, we have a system now, or a high power jet thing to kind of put on the end of the garden hose. So we can go out and clear it ourselves, unless it gets, you know, really bad, but not something we still want to have to do.
Yeah.
With any regularity.
Yeah, for sure.
And after we talked last week and talked about different options for constipation, I had a few days in a row. I didn't need to start those. Started going for a couple days, kind of loose, and then Wednesday had diarrhea so bad I had to leave a meeting to go to the bathroom. And then the next couple, yeah, it's still just been all over the place, back and forth from diarrhea, constipation, and stool consistency. Okay. But today and yesterday are not as bad. There's a potential that it's on the rise. Still too early to tell, and not at all convincing, but, you know, not as bad as some of the days have been. Mm-hmm. How long, you know, what do you think about continuing the low fat route? Like if it would have made it's
2 year.
Relatively. It is moderately. Yeah. I mean, and especially too, trying to get it enough. I've lost a few pounds, which it's hard to pull out. Like, I think I started losing some weight at the very beginning of when I started the low fat, like too soon for it to have made a difference. It might just be tied to when the stool consistency changed. But now that I'm low fat also, it is definitely harder to replace all of those calories. I mean, I'm making a conscious effort to do so, but I know there are some meals and days that I probably don't get as many as I would if I were grabbing spoonfuls of yogurt and peanut butter and nuts and pouring the olive oil and avocado onto things.
Yeah.
And we're going out for a steak dinner tonight for a friend's birthday.
Well, enjoy that regardless, please. I would probably say, you know, if you want to give it a couple more days, if you feel like things are kind of on the upswing, maybe, just to see, you know, if that's helpful, sure, go ahead. But I would probably, and obviously there are many factors involved here, right? And maybe there's fat malabsorption on top of something else. But I probably wouldn't continue it for longer than another mm-hmm. 5 to 7 days.
It's something like, you know, enjoy the steak dinner tonight. Does that throw me back then a couple more days?
It shouldn't. No.
So even a fatty meal tonight wouldn't, it's still in a couple days. It still 5 to 7 days total, even with a fatty meal coming tonight, mm-hmm. potentially.
Yeah.
Okay. And I was trying to just do the diet before adding in any other supplements, like hoping I could see some difference just with what I was eating. You know, I sort of took a quick inventory of what I have left of the healthy gut stuff, the digestive enzymes and the HDL. I think I'm going to start the HDL here shortly. Maybe a few more days of whenever I stop, you know, focusing on low fat. I still probably should be mindful of maybe not quite as fatty as I used to be, but yeah, starting back up with the HDL and then ordering one of the other options we talked about, it of some other hydrochloric acid with pepsin. Great. Continue, and then start the digestive enzymes after that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the other thing to consider down the road would be to try a different kind of probiotic. There are a lot of strains out there, a lot of evidence-based strains. The only one we've really used is the BioGaia, right? The Arurai.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a really great one.
Constipation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although it has some other, you know, it's seems to be beneficial for a lot of things. But yes, constipation was kind of the main thing there. So if at some point we want to switch and try something else, there are plenty of strains out there mm-hmm. that are good. That, you know, again, it's hard to know what's going to move the needle. you obviously weren't taking another probiotic strain when things were really good or better mm-hmm. than they were, right? So maybe that's not the route to go, but it is an option.
Yeah. Okay. When I went to the endocrinologist last night, I think we talked a couple weeks ago of why, you know, not sure why he didn't order T3 free and all the tests that he did the previous time. And he wasn't sure either. So I have to go in for another fasting blood work, follow back up with him. And he ordered a bone density scan. And regardless of the ones he didn't order that are coming, like they'll be potentially useful information, but the estrogen levels are still low. And they've been low now for several months. Who knows how long prior to even getting the first test. And it just sounds like the risks of being that low at this age are high. In his take, and I mean, which I know is true, is, you know, bone density stuff. And I learned too a little more. I knew a little bit of this, but more from talking to my mom of family history and issues that women have with bone density in our family. And none that we know of breast cancer or blood clots, which seem to be the risks of the hormone replacement therapy. Mm-hmm. What are your takes on cognitive issues with low estrogen? The doctor didn't seem to think that was much of a concern or that it was very conclusive. I've listened to some podcasts, and I think you've made reference to concerns with cognitive decline, and the other stuff I listened to was like more Alzheimer's specific, which I do have a family history of also. Mm-hmm. What do you take?
I think it's a potential concern for sure. But again, there's so many factors that influence cognitive health and cognitive decline or lack thereof that I think it's hard to kind of put your finger on one thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would certainly say it's a concern. But how much of a concern is probably going to be individual. And it's probably going to be more of a concern if this has been going on for a long time versus if it's been a relatively short amount of time.
Right.
If we're talking 5, 10, 15 years, that's much different than, you know, 2 or 3 years, even though 2 or 3 years is still a potentially long time, right? It's uh-huh. all be kind of, it's all context and it's all relative.
What it sounds like for the osteoporosis stuff, it's even a couple of years, I mean, is
for bone health,
a long time, could be too much, you know, I mean, I'm at the time now where I should do something about it.
Yeah, I agree.
And do you have any experience with or insight on the types? So, you know, the options that he said were two separate pills, estrogen and progestin, I think. One pill, birth control pill, that would have both, that's the most convenient, that slightly increases your already very low risk of the blood clots and breast cancer. A patch for the estrogen and a pill for the progestin. I don't know if it's progestin or if I'm saying that right. I forget, but.
Yeah, I would defer to somebody who is more well-versed in that area.
Sure.
There's one.
I know it's a very specific question. I didn't know if you had any.
Yeah. And I've heard
anybody else
differing opinions. And again, it's not not my area of expertise. Let me see.
Can I ask a question? Tracy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're either perimenopausal or menopausal. Is that right?
Well, that's probably not. The tests he's ordering now again may give a little more insight in as to why the estrogen levels are low. They may not. I mean, really, like T3 free is going to come back low. Estrogen's low, so it's a question of what is causing that. And
did they test?
I could
LH and FSH.
Go ahead. I don't think this time around. Should have had those out. So it could be early menopause, Stuart. Like I'm 42, so that would be very early.
Yeah, could be peri. It wouldn't necessarily be. Yeah, you just don't know. The thing I was going to say, which is not necessarily anything specific, is that I've been listening to a podcast because one of my employees pointed it out to me, and just because I'm so interested in health and have a lot of women in my life, friends who are women and other things, I end up doing a lot of listening to things for women's health. And there's a podcast that I really enjoy called Hit Play Not Pause. That's for women who are either approaching menopause or perimenopausal or postmenopausal. And she interviews a lot of really neat people.
Okay.
Really broad spectrum. And if you want me to share that link with you, I can send it to you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
You know, you may or may not like it, but when you talk about things like bone densities, you know, and I guess it probably wasn't even just there. There's two good podcasts that were on Chatterjee's on, oh, what's the name of his on the Feel Better, Live More podcast. And one of them was with Tommy Wood. And the other one was with somebody they mentioned in the Tommy Wood one, which is a woman who did just tons of research. And that one's really long, the woman one, but there's a section right in the middle about an hour into this 2-hour podcast where she talks about things women should definitely do as they approach menopause or in menopause to keep their bone density to, you know, and all the stuff she said sounds like things that could have come out of Megan's mouth, but it's kind of nice to hear.
Do you remember who it was?
I might be able to figure it out.
That's okay. I'll find it.
Let me see if I can, if I do see all and see what I've played, then I can probably find it because it's one of the ones I played. Dr. Gabrielle Lyon.
Oh, yeah. Yep. She's great.
And that's like a 2-hour podcast. It's in there. If you want to know, it's episode 296 under which one is this? Sorry. Under Feel Better, Live More.
Okay.
And it was funny because when he was interviewing Tommy Wood and he brought up Gabrielle Lyon, Tommy Wood said, before I say anything else, I'll say, whatever she said goes. Like, she's really good. So,
yeah.
But yeah, just she had some specific advice that sounded really good, which was had to do with some how important high intensity interval training was, and not a lot. I mean, what she said, what she seemed to say, or what I incorporated in my brain is I hear people say for a guy once a week at my age, at age 60, if I do some sprinting, that is plenty. You know, and on that day, that would be my only workout. And I've been trying to get around to doing that. As a matter of fact, once last week, I did one sprint and I paid for it the next day. I haven't sprinted in so long. I've been working so hard all my life. I was a sprinter. I was really good at short bursts and never good at sustain anything. And so for the last 4 years while I've been mountain biking, I've been trying to make things sustainable and working on lower heart rate stuff, but I haven't done any sprinting. Man, my legs wouldn't let me sleep that night at all. Mm-hmm. And it was like one 10-second sprint, but it was all out.
That means you were actually doing it right, Stuart.
I believe that. Yeah. I think I have really good fast twitch muscle stuff. I just haven't used it.
Yeah. I've always been the opposite.
You're
good for endurance. Yeah. Not fast twitch. But I mean, I have done periods of high interval training. It's tough, but bone density wise, I didn't realize that was a
That wasn't thing, bone density. Hits. That was just overall health, because it's supposed to help.
Makes sense.
You should go listen to the podcast. I think if you don't want to listen to the whole thing, if you started about, you know, 50 minutes in, you only might have to listen to 20 minutes to find it. I think it was an hour, 12 minutes was the actual point where she started saying these specific things for people, for women in menopause. And one of them was that she actually recommended that they do sprinting twice a week. Now this is, I mean, my definition of sprinting and hers sounded similar is what pretty much comes from Mark Sisson. And he just says, you know, you warm up, you get a good walking warm up. And then you go as hard as you can, but you want to make sure that length of time you go that hard is sustainable. I mean, that you don't, if he says, if you notice you start to slow down, stop. So it could only be 10 seconds, right? It's just like, you're not trying to train your body to go 90% or 80%, you're trying to train your body to go 100%. And then rest for as long as it takes to get your heart rate back to normal. And then do it again and do that. You know, like for me, who have never done it, I haven't done it recently. I'm like once or twice is enough, obviously, until I get my body adapted. But, you know, maybe 4 or 5 times. And Mark Sisson, again, one source says, you know, you do that once a week. And on that day, that's the only real exercise. You know, movement's fine, walking's fine, but that's the only real exercise on that day. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on that, Megan?
I agree. Most people don't sprint correctly.
And so you think my description of sprinting was pretty close?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you don't need a lot to get the benefits. Obviously, the more conditioned you are, the more you'll need over time. Right. So in 6 months, one sprint isn't going to do much for you.
Right. Right.
But yes, I agree with that definition.
No, I mean, basically what Mark said was, you know, maybe 5 or 6 and a half an hour, but the length, the length of the sprint was, you know, he said, if you're falling off at all in speed, you're done.
Yep.
You know, you don't care if it's 10 seconds, 15 seconds. He says, you're really conditioned and you're good at it, you'd probably pull off 30 seconds. But that was literally like the longest number he gave.
Yep.
For a true sprint. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a really big workout. You know, you need 20 or 30 minutes of time to get warmed up and do a few sprints. But this woman was saying that it was more important for women as they age to do not only once a week, but probably twice a week.
Okay.
And that, you know, one of the things she pushed, that Gabriel Lyons pushed, was that your muscles are an endocrine organ. And this podcast, that they are really important in the whole endocrine system. And when you don't have enough muscle mass, one of the things she was really, I think it was in this podcast, because I listen to so many podcasts, I can't always separate them, but was just that if you don't have enough, that when you talk about people having problems with their health, be it, you know, problems with blood sugar or problems with other things not in balance, thinking about how much muscle mass you have is way more important than thinking about how much you weigh, for instance. And so mm-hmm. if you're not pushing your muscles, and it's one of the places I really haven't figured out how to fit it in my world, but I really want to start doing some heavy lifting. And I don't think it has to be very much. It just has to be enough that I do it on a regular basis and cause my body to try. And she was big into this too. So that's a good podcast. Tommy Woods was too. Both of them on. And I'll send you both those podcasts, the Feel Better, Live More, and the Hit Play, Not Pause.
Thanks, Stuart.
Yeah.
Megan, you'd asked about the FSH and LH. He didn't test them this time, but last time in the fall, FSH was 13.3 and LH was 3.9.
Okay. Okay.
Postmenopausal, you'd expect FSH to be 23 or above. Right. So this was when I still had the IUD. So that was part of too, wanting to wait several months. So I got that removed shortly after.
And it was a hormonal IUD?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I used to have the copper one, but now this one was the hormonal one. So we'll see when they come back this next time.
Okay.
But, you know, I think just like everyone blaming everything on weight loss, and which is kind of frustrating. I mean, I don't disagree that I'm underweight, and that is probably adding to some of these numbers and symptoms. But it feels like that all the doctors just think, well, go take care of that. Like, that's your thing to fix. Like, there's nothing else wrong.
Right.
Whether they think I just want to be skinny, or, you know, because of the activities and exercise I'm doing, everyone questions, like, how active are you? Tell me what you eat. Like,
well, we know here how much you eat. Eating is, you know, it's kind of like the second full-time job sometimes. Yeah. So yeah, it does seem like there's another factor at play.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, I'd like to know, like, if I do go back to just as much fat as I was eating, not modifying anything else, if I lose weight just when the stool consistency changed, if there's something correlated there. Because that's the whole couple years prior to AIP, I was losing weight. That's part of what led me down this route. And then when I started AIP, which, you know, in hindsight, probably wasn't the best from looking at it from that angle, because then I plummeted even more. And that's, I think, what doctors think, like, well, you're way too restrictive. And it seems like they still think that I am, though I was restrictive at that point. You know, plenty of people are gluten-free. Like, I'm not that restrictive right now.
Right.
Do you think sauerkraut could play into the change? Could that be a current
Eating sauerkraut or not eating sauerkraut?
Yeah. eating just sauerkraut existing in the world. No, eating sauerkraut daily and trying to micro look at everything I've done in the last month that was different than before. Like our batch of homemade sauerkraut got done and been eating that like every day. I'm like, oh, maybe I should stop that for a little while.
I can't eat anything like sauerkraut.
I see people react very differently to fermented foods. And if it's a homemade version, you know, you have another level of unpredictability there. Right. So yeah, it's certainly possible. And that might be another lever to pull to experiment with. How much were you consuming or are you consuming daily?
Not a huge amount, but 3 to 5 bites a day, you know, pulling out a small potent portion. Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I would consider just dropping it for a week or two to see what happens. Did you start consuming it around the time that approximately?
A little before that, yeah. Though when I was in Ohio, I didn't have any. But I had started it prior to that. The week there, didn't have any, and then started again when I got back. So,
yeah.
And the issue started right after I got back, which was, I guess, after the week off of having it. But it had still already been in the system. And then shortly thereafter, I reintroduced it.
Sure. Yeah, I it's a good question. And I think it's worth playing with.
Yeah. In a few weeks, I haven't had questions submitted, which is unusual.
I know.
You know, every once in a while, it's not unusual, but a few in a row is.
Yeah, I hope common. I hope our form is working. I'll double check. But I also don't mind this either.
Hey, Megan, have you ever worked with a breast cancer or cancer survivor woman who ended up with neuropathy and trying to help them with their neuropathy from their chemo?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Do you have any suggestions?
Cancer survivors, yes. Chemo-induced neuropathy, no. Neuropathy from other causes, yes. So not that particular
reason. I guess the question is, have you ever seen somebody be able to significantly improve their neuropathy through anything?
Outside of the realm of chemo-induced neuropathy?
Sure. I mean, I don't know what the difference would be.
Well, yeah, I don't know enough about chemo-induced neuropathy to.
And I don't know enough about neuropathy.
Yeah. I mean, yes, there are some things dietarily, supplementally, nutritionally, counts as dietarily, lifestyle-wise that can be beneficial.
Can you look at mend.me as a website? Because my friend who has neuropathy in her feet from chemo and is a breast cancer survivor, this is a friend of hers is involved in this company. And the friend said, hey, you should take, and I think it's called Regenerate is one of their products. I mean, at a glance, it was like, oh yeah, it might be something.
What does it have?
I'll try and write you a question about this and see if you can do a deeper dive.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's a lot of stuff in here.
Oh, in the mend?
In the regenerate.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in regenerate.
It kind of seems like a... It's not really like a multivitamin on steroids because there's a lot more in there and it doesn't seem to have all of the vitamins and minerals. You know, some of these may have some beneficial effects for neuropathy in particular. They're all seemingly good.
It's not aimed at neuropathy. It was just a comment that this person made to, you know, somebody in the company made to her friend saying, hey, this might help you with your neuropathy. When I think about neuropathy in the feet particularly, I think about how getting out of modern sneakers with arch support and other things to improve blood flow because your foot doesn't pump when it's in an arch support.
Yep.
My friend is a little resistant to that, but Are you familiar with Oesch shoes? O-E-S-H?
O-E-S-H?
I think it's O-E-S-H. So I...
Yeah.
They make O-E-S-H. A minimalist shoe, but it's really a person who did just tons of research about the problems with modern shoes before she decided to stop being a professor and start being a shoemaker. I'd never heard of it before.
No, I'm not familiar with them, but they look great.
Well, and it seems like she's coming at it from a really nice science direction where she did a lot of studying of what you want out of a shoe and tried not to make something that interfered with what you want.
Yeah, it's the roomy footwear that is what you want, and that looks like what she's getting at here.
Well, it's not just roomy. In her case, she was aiming it at women, and so it has a narrower heel than you'll see in a men's roomy footwear.
Yes. Okay.
And is it O-E-S-H?
O-E-S-H. Yep. Yeah, these look great. I'll have to look more into them. But something like this, I mean, they're not Vibram or Vibram Five Fingers, right? That they're something that looks like a normal shoe. So even trying something like this could be, you know, maybe low hanging if she's up for it.
Yeah. No, it was funny because my friend, you know, I said something about going to a minimalist shoe and she said, I don't think I can actually do that because I'm used to having an elevated heel. And, you know, that gets stuff shortened in the back of your calf and it makes problems when you transition. But then she said she walked around her house all day barefoot. And I said, well, if you can walk around your house all day barefoot, you can walk for a little while in these shoes that don't have an elevated heel. You know, I said, and I'm not telling you to go out and run a marathon or something in them or to go for a long walk. I'm saying, put them on and use them some of the time and get out of your shoes that are acting like a cast on your foot. Because if you've got neuropathy in your foot, circulation is going to be one of the things that could help. I figured that the different things that could potentially help would be, you know, nutrition, nutrient stuff potentially, and some form of stimulation and blood flow, mm-hmm. which means strengthening, which barefoot or other things really helps with. But just walking around the house is not really going barefoot. Going for a walk for a while barefoot is different. But...
Right. Yeah, there is, I think, a little bit of, and I would have to look into this, it's been a while, some preliminary evidence looking at red light therapy for neuropathy.
Okay.
So that could be another tool in the toolbox, but it probably wouldn't be like, you know, I would go for the lower hanging fruits first.
Yeah, the other one I thought of, just my brain tends to look at things that other people have done in other areas that somehow seem related. And you know who Terry Walls is? Mm-hmm. And her work with MS. Well, MS is neurological damage, right? And neuropathy is neurological damage. So it seems like some of the ideas that Terry Wall's work might cross over. And one of the things she used in trying to get her nerves to function right again was some kind of neurological stimulation, electrostim. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not going to be nothing like this. If you just go to a doctor and ask them what you can do, they're not going to come up with this stuff, right? Or most of them aren't. And unfortunately, my comment by my friend when I said, you know, thoughts about healing her neuropathy, she said, well, that's not really the way I look at it. I don't think you can heal it. And I'm like, well, if you don't think you can heal it, you're not ever going to heal it. You know, I mean, I think, unfortunately, my experience says that doctors should never say you can't heal something. They should say it could be difficult or, you know, it will take a long time or should give it a lot of time. But they shouldn't say that's impossible because I've had lots of things get better in my body that I've damaged at a period in time that doctors say, well, no, that'll never happen. If it's been that long, nothing will improve. Yeah. It's like, what?
It's a massive disservice to say it's impossible. I totally agree.
You know, and if you expect it to go back to 100% normal, maybe that is impossible. But if you expect to get a significant improvement, to an extent where you might not even be able to tell the difference between where you're at and what normal was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the expectancy effect is huge. You know, if you,
that's the other thing I said, I said the placebo effect is real. If you don't think it can happen, it's probably not going to happen.
That's right.
No, that doesn't mean you should get all excited and think it's going to happen in 3 weeks. Then you'll just get bummed out.
Yeah. No, so true. I completely agree.
I'm going to die, but that's not going to stop me from trying to be healthier until I do.
I like that mindset over the, well, I've got to die of something. So, you know, I'm going to, you know, smoke until I do, or, you know, insert whatever vice you want.
Yeah. I hear a lot, like there's nothing you can do. This is coming for all of us, you know, whatever age related condition, fill in the blank. But...
Well, most, I would say, despite the fact that we all are going to die, most things that people talk about as age related conditions are not what I think is the norm for an ancestrally healthy human.
For sure.
You know, if they're normal in our weird societies, in Western, what's it, weird, Western industrialized, educated. Do you know that one, that acronym?
Yep.
Yeah.
I hadn't, but I like that.
I think is democratic.
Yeah, democratic is one of them. Yeah. And it's where you see all these diseases of age, or diseases of whatever, modernity. And I loved one of the things where, is it the, what's the most common gene associated that they say is associated with Alzheimer's?
APOE4.
Yeah. They said, yeah, if you live in America and you're APOE4, yes, it correlates. But if you live in some place in Africa, it doesn't correlate at all. You know, they gave a location.
Yeah.
And it's like, and that just, that infuriates me. It's just like, you're telling people when they get tested that they're on a track to get this. And you should be telling them, there's no reason why you have to be on a track to get this.
Yep.
You know, there's things you can do. Whereas, you know, I have a friend and her family who they have that gene whatever it is, marker.
Variant, polymorphism.
And they're all using intermittent use of the drug that's for anti-rejection, and I'm blanking on the name because they're using intermittent rapamycin because it's supposed to downregulate the immune system. And it's just like, yeah, but there's probably other things you could do that would be a whole lot safer.
I agree. There's a lot of people in the anti.
That's a totally quadrant four intervention that you have no idea in the long run what it's going to do to you.
Yeah.
Whereas if you were to just go lift heavy things, sprint once a week or twice a week, eat healthy food, move a lot, you probably reduce your odds of getting Alzheimer's by way more than that, what you're doing.
Get outside, get some sleep, be socially connected.
Reduce meditation, reduce your stress.
Yep. When you are stressed, go for a walk. Don't stew in it.
Yeah.
Anyways, thanks.
Hey, of course. And real quick, I wanted to run the brand by you of the things I have on my Willoughby cart. Get your opinion, Megan. Betaine HCL from Thorne.
Yep, that's good.
With pepsin. And the motility activator is a prokinetic, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be that or the Iberogast, one or the other, to take at a time?
Probably, yeah. Most likely.
And are those better for when I am more in a period of constipation?
Most likely, yes.
Okay.
But there are
not necessarily daily, regular, ongoing.
It can be very helpful. Just because motility could look different when you're looking at different parts of the gut, right? But yes, I would probably say if you're having a period of loose stools, diarrhea, to not start them at that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm not going to start all of these at once anyway, but just ones we've recently talked about. The Trifalia, I think, was for
constipation,
for motility, for constipation. Yeah. Cut. And that's from Banyan Botanicals.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And then Digestive Enzymes Ultra from Pure.
Yep. Those are all good.
Okay. But there was one more thing I was going to say on the supplement front, but don't remember. That's okay.
Right. Anything else from either of you?
Don't think so. Thank you very much.
Okay. Of course. Yeah, thanks for joining. Have a great
day. Good luck, guys. Tracy.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.